This is the first day of this December 2009 four-day session. And I'm going to start by reading segments from a book called The Original Face, an anthology of Rinzai Zen. And it's just what it says. That is, Rinzai, in this case meaning Japanese Rinzai Zen. I mean, Rinzai is the Japanese word, Japanized form of the Chinese master Lin Chi. So in other words, they mean the same thing. There's the Lin Chi lineage became the Rinzai lineage in Japan, but here the editor presents the teachings of the Japanese part of that line. And it is translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. Most of the texts that have been translated into English are of Chinese teachers. Zen, or as it's called in China, Chan originated in China, not in Japan. But here we have some Japanese teachers, beginning with Torii. Torii was the successor to Hakuin. I have very little material on him. I couldn't find anything with the books I brought here. He's actually the last of the latest of the masters presented in this book, and lived in the late 1700s, early 1800s. So just around the birth of our country. He just offers up a few sentences, that is the editor in the introduction. Torii, like Ananda of old, was first awakened as he began to lie down, exhausted by his intense efforts in Zazen. Later, so after his awakening, he met Hakuin, but became desperately ill and had to be healed before continuing his work with Hakuin. And the only other thing we have is that we're told here that he wrote a detailed history of Zen and a study of the five houses of classical Chan, that is, in China. So here we are. Now, Torii's own words, as translated anyway. In what the Zen school calls ascending directly from the state of ordinary person to Buddha, there are five discriminations. One is the meaning of same nature. Second, the meaning of different paths. Third, the meaning of urgency. Fourth, the meaning of progressive practice. And fifth, the meaning of returning to the basis. This is the essential road. I have to say, I've never heard of this, where he says there are five discriminations. So this is new to me too. And then he goes through these five. First, same nature. The fundamental nature inherent in sentient beings is not other than the fundamental nature of all the Buddhas of the past, present, and future. Let me just pause here and remind everyone that when he says Buddhas, he means enlightened ones, anyone who's come to true realization. And sentient beings is the term that translators use in referring to the so-called unenlightened beings. sometimes say ordinary people, sentient beings or ordinary people, the unenlightened. So here is what is so fundamental, so radical about Zen teaching. The fundamental nature inherent in ordinary people is no other than the fundamental nature of all the enlightened ones. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. All beings, Buddha just means enlightened. This is not only the beginning of the Hakuin chant, but the end. And this very body, the body of Buddha. Wherever you are in your practice, however long or short you've been practicing, this very body, the body of Buddha. And then referring again to ordinary beings, their range of powers and qualities are also equal. That is, he's referring to both so-called ordinary people and the enlightened ones. Their range of powers and qualities are also equal. Equal. Their lights are radiant. Their knowledge, wisdom, and miraculous powers are all the same. This may be likened to the rays of the sun shining everywhere on the mountains, rivers, and plains, so nothing is not illumined. Nothing is not illumined. Or no one is not illumined. The Buddha himself put it very simply, this mind is bright and luminous, but it is stained by adventitious defilements. Adventitious meaning not intrinsic to us, that is, defilements that we've acquired through our upbringing, our socialization process and education, our conditioning, in other words. He goes on, gold and jewels are bright in themselves even when they are in mud. However, blind people do not see, are not aware of this light, even though they are in its very midst. They are to be pitied. So this is the establishing the bedrock of faith in Buddhism, certainly in Zen, that we don't have to acquire anything, we don't have to attain anything, we don't have to get anywhere or get anything, but just awaken to the fact that we have always had this perfect true mind, true nature. And then he takes the second of what he above refers to as the five discriminations. Second, different paths. Although in their fundamental nature, Buddhas and sentient beings are the same substance, no different, the directions of their minds are different. Buddhas shine inward to illumine the basic mind, whereas sentient beings turn outward and get involved with myriad things. That is why sentient beings create greed and lust for things they desire, anger and rage toward people they dislike, and become fools by becoming congealed in their thoughts. confused and stupefied by these three poisons, they have lost their very fundamental mind. So just to get a kind of an overarching understanding of what we are doing in practice, what we are endeavoring to do, think of it this way, that we're, it's just as he says, that we're trying to reverse our tendency to be obsessed with objects. Not just physical objects, people and things, but mental objects. This is where all the trouble starts, with our attachment to our thoughts. So mostly, most people without practice, and all of us probably, but until coming to practice, are oriented in a centripetal way, an outgoing way, with our attention constantly being scattered, diverted to this or that, him or her, them, future, past, thoughts, concepts, opinions, notions, principles, goals. We direct our attention to things. Now, we want to reverse that and learn to not grasp at mental objects and physical objects, but to turn the mind back. And this is most plainly, clearly done in the sitting facing the wall. We're not visually involved with anything. We're not really seeing the wall or getting involved with any aspect of the wall, but we're turning the mind back to the breath, the koan, whatever our practice is. And the breath is not an object. I mean, we can objectify it. We can make it a thing in our mind, but that's not its real nature. The real nature of the breath is flux. It's pure experience. It's not so much the breath as breathing, as a verb, as a process. Same with the koan, really, although it appears to be that we're focusing on this word or words, but as we transcend the word or the words and the concepts, then we come to see that we're really dwelling in no mind. Not the stuff of the mind, not mental objects, but no mind, which is the same with the breath. So just to repeat here, it says, sentient beings, on the other hand, turn outward and get involved with myriad things. That is why that outward orientation, that is why sentient beings create greed and lust for things they desire. That's the first of the three poisons, greed. Anger toward people they dislike, that's the second. And become fools by becoming congealed in their thoughts. The third is, usually we say, this has different translations, but delusion is the one we use. Greed, anger, and delusion. That we create, or we well, he says we create greed, anger, and delusion because of this this looking outward and grasping. And then as a result, we are separated, it would seem, we're separated from this fundamental Buddha mind. And then he goes on to link each of these three poisons to the three and then four of the lowest of the six realms of existence. For new people, the six realms of unenlightened existence is just a way to describe different aspects of ignorance, ways of experiencing reality. The lowest is hell. The next one up is hungry ghosts or thirsty spirits. This is just the way of referring to those who are dominated by their cravings, addictions, you might say. And the next one up is animals. And the next one up are asuras. Asuras is variously translated as fighting demons, titans, fighting titans. It's those who are consumed by power and dominance. Of course, each of these realms, and then the next two, the fifth and the sixth, is the human realm and the heavenly realm, the Deva realm, the realm of great fortune and blessings. I think traditionally, historically, these six were taken quite literally. Who can say they aren't to be taken literally? Who can say that there is no, there are no hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits that are invisible to us and that are crying out for help? But in addition to taking them literally, they can also be taken psychologically, as I've indicated in just the few things I've said about these realms. So again, he starts with these three poisons. He says, those in whom greed runs deep turn into hungry ghosts. Those in whom anger runs deep become asuras. And those deep in delusion become animals. Then he says, those in whom these three poisons are equal fall into hell and suffer various miseries. These are called the four bad dispositions. They are most dreadful. I've also never heard this, that if you have the three poisons in roughly equally, if you're vulnerable to all three, then you fall into hell. Doesn't quite make sense to me, hell being the lowest. Hell, by the way, we may conjure up, when we hear hell, we may conjure up images of, you know, like you see in cartoons in The New Yorker, you know, flames leaping up and pitchforks and, but that's just a, you know, cartoonist rendition of it. We can think of hell. There are places in the world now that are hellish. In this country and other countries, people are suffering just unspeakable pain and misery in these places on the earth. And then those are the four lowest of the six realms, if I don't like this. And then he says, even though they have greed, anger, and folly, because that's the nature, that's what we're stuck with in the six realms of unenlightened existence, even though they have greed, anger, and delusion, those who restrain themselves and are not self-indulgent are in the human realm, and in this way will not lose this bodily form life after life. So this is good news for many of us, that yes, we may have, to one degree or another, elements of greed and hostility and delusion. But if we can restrain ourselves, not to use the wording of the ninth precept, not to indulge in anger, for example, but to exercise restraint, just to take one example, if we can do that, if we can restrain ourselves and not be self-indulgent, in this way, we will not sink to a non-human rebirth after death. We will not lose this human body, life after life, which is a great concession, consolation rather. It's a great consolation because, according to Buddhist teaching, it is only from the human experience that we can realize this enlightened nature of ours, that we can come to awakening. And then he takes the highest of the unenlightened realms, that of the gods or devas, as they're traditionally called. He says, those in whom greed, anger, and delusion gradually quiet down, and who are not self-indulgent, even though they don't restrain themselves, whatever that means, are born in heaven, known as gods of the six heavens of desire. This, I remember when in the early years when I heard Roshi Kaplow giving teishos referring to these six realms, it all seemed so foreign. And but over the years, I've come to find that it's a very useful way of describing the different experiences that we have. You could say that each one of us can move through these different realms depending on our state of mind. But then we can also see that different people spend more time, say, in hell, or as hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits, or animal-like people blessed with amazing good fortune and wealth and beauty, and that would be the highest realm, the deva realm. And then he gets into one that I'm not so familiar with. Those in whom the nature of the three poisons has died out, but though they have qualities of calmness and wisdom, they have views attached to calmness and have residual habits of aversion and ignorance, are born among the 18 kinds of heaven of pure form. When the love for calmness is done with, but one has not yet opened up the knowledge and insight of the enlightened ones, this is called the four formless heavens. These would be I think this is the four realms above the six realms of unenlightened existence. Those who practice discipleship and self-enlightenment are in these latter heavens. Yeah, this is trouble for a translator. Those who practice discipleship just means those who have heard the teaching of the Dharma and have accepted it. That would be the practice of discipleship. And the self-enlightenment called, the other one I just mentioned is called Shravaka Buddhas, and then the self-enlightenment refers to Pratyeka Buddhas, which are those who somehow, without a teacher, come to awakening, but then don't extend themselves to share it with others, but just carry on with their own joy of enlightenment. We don't want to dwell too much on all these distinctions. There's a lot more to cover here. So don't worry about it. If this seems confusing, just stay with your practice. Which reminds me, in listening to Taisho, what you don't want to do is try to sort out things that you don't understand, but instead to just listen. Just listen without clinging to anything that's said, or certainly not clinging to any thoughts of what's said. And then as soon as Taisho is over, to forget everything that was said. Forget it. Let it go. Otherwise, you're clinging to it. You're clinging to my words. And listening to Taisho in this way, this rests on the faith that what you're ready to understand, you will, and what you're not ready to, you won't, but will someday if you continue in practice. But it doesn't help to try to analyze what is being said. And then he says, as sort of a summation, if you are wondering how this all comes about, you create these worlds with your minds deeply afflicted by greed, anger, and delusion, producing such bodily forms as a result. Therefore, unless you extinguish these afflictions and their active expressions, you cannot be liberated. Unless you are liberated from the world of suffering of these six dispositions, there is no real peace. So even the highest realm, let's take that one, because that's what seems so appealing to the ordinary person, the realm of celebrities and rock stars and Tiger Woods and others. There's no real peace because it's not stable. There's no security in that realm, as Tiger will confirm. We reach these heights of fame and glory and beauty and so forth, talent, magnificent talents of music and acting and other things, writing, but then we die. Or even before that, as so often is the case, we know this, as so often is the case, we sink into the lower realms lower than the heavenly realm of addictions and intense suffering, animal-like behavior, states of competition, endless competition, and wanting to always be dominating others. And all this moves along through change, that the beautiful can't remain beautiful to the same extent, the powerful the same thing, those gifted with extraordinary intelligence and writing ability also eventually will lose that. Anything we can acquire, we can lose. The Tiger Woods story is a classic case of a fall, a tragic fall out of the heights of fortune and talent, until true enlightenment, deep enlightenment, these forces of greed, craving, hostility and delusion, they're still there in one form or another. Their roots are still secure in the mind. He goes on, if you want to be free from this world of suffering, first you must contemplate impermanence. Those who are born must inevitably die. Even the young are not exempt. Even the strong are in danger. Even the rich and prosperous decline. Even the noble and exalted cannot remain that way. Even a long life does not last more than 80 years or so. All right, let's say 90 or 100 these days. This was the early 1800s he wrote this. Thus, the world being impermanent, there is nothing enjoyable. Which of course, he means nothing ultimately enjoyable. There's plenty enjoyable, as we all know, but nothing we can hold on to. He says, the poor suffer from lack, the rich suffer from possessions, the high suffer from their high status, the low suffer from their low status, they suffer over food and clothing, suffer over wives and children, suffer over wealth, suffer over official rank. Anyway, if you don't annihilate the nature of afflictions somehow, and arrive on the path of liberation, even if you ascend to the rank of sovereign of a nation, great minister, deity, spirit, or wizard, it is still evanescent as lightning and morning dew, lasting only for a while. He's laying out here what may be the most profound, the most fundamental spur to practice is the certainty of our death and the uncertainty of the time of our death and everything else that we can't hold on to. Dogen said it in a way that can't be improved on. He said, those who would practice the Dharma must deeply, deeply feel the passing nature of things and have faith in karma. Anyone who deeply, deeply recognizes the impermanence of all worldly things is poised to be able to practice in the way, practice most effectively. This one phrase I have to repeat. He says the poor suffer from lack, the rich suffer from possessions. Well, probably anyone who comes to Sesshin recognizes the truth of this, that we spend so much time trying to acquire more and more and more to preserve our comfort and security, and our possessions come to possess us. Even just home ownership. Home ownership brings an unending series of problems, just physical problems that cost money and time to maintain the house. He goes on, when conditions meet, everything sure seems to exist. But when the conditions disintegrate, emptiness. Here, too, he's speaking from a very fundamental understanding of the nature of phenomena. And then he gets more specific. This body is acquired through the relationship of father and mother, comes from their conditions. Solidity becomes skin, flesh, ligament, and bone. Fluidity becomes spittle, tears, pus, and blood. Heat becomes warmth and flexibility. Air becomes breath and movement. He's basing this structure on the four, what are called the four elements, fire, earth, air, and water. When these four conditions suddenly are exhausted, the body gets cold and the breath stops. There is nothing called me. At that time, this body is really not our own. It is only a temporary inn. How can we be so greedily attached to this temporary inn that we ignore eternity? Well, eternity is not really such a Buddhist word. We can say that we ignore that which is beyond change. I often wonder what these great masters who lived in previous centuries, what they would see in our contemporary society of where we are just awash in messages that ignore that which is beyond change, that which is beyond phenomena, messages that that exalt the impermanent appearance and the physical and possessions, acquisitions, and so forth. This world of advertising and marketing. We really do have quite a challenge living as we do, surrounded by what the media is pouring out, broadcasting all the time. Everything designed with fiendish skill at capturing our attention, drawing our attention outward to the world of things. And then he says, contemplating these four transcendences, and he mentions them, impermanence, suffering, emptiness, and selflessness, seeking the way of enlightenment is called the teaching of four realities. This is the essential gateway to beginning entry into the way for all enlightened ones. So I would go so far as to say that anyone who takes up Zen practice and does and sits with any regularity, especially anyone who comes to Sesshin, is almost by definition is someone who has considered and reflected upon the impermanent nature of this world, the inevitability of suffering or dissatisfaction, and has some clue of a realm of no self, a realm that is beyond self and other. It's really a very evolved population, those who practice, and especially those who take the time, mostly it's vacation time, take the time to come to Sesshin. We are all of us here are blessed with tremendously good karma to have landed on this path, to be able to have a practice where we're not just reading about the truth, the Dharma. We're not just appreciating the philosophical, appreciating the Dharma philosophically, psychologically, but we're walking it, we're doing it. This is itself is the effect. Our finding ourselves here is the effect of a great deal of wholesome thoughts, actions, and words of the past. I think it can be helpful at times, especially at times of doubt and when one is feeling inadequate in one's practice. It's helpful to acknowledge this, and it's true. We have wonderful, wonderful karma to have found our way here, all of us. How can we use that most effectively? And in doing so, sowing even better karma, plowing these gains back into the principle, let's put it that way. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.